Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
It's time to hear the other side of the news.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message. Wake up. Every station is a gentrification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murdoch is Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen, the camera, the sword, buy a Coke, buy a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
The other side of the news.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need, but do we even know who plants the seeds? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them, they're just selling fruit. Flim flam diagram, data jam, handicap caught it, yo, you bought it. My mind is a profitable thing to waste, you want another taste, babe? Freedom is a rumor.
Good afternoon and welcome to another edition of The Other Side. Today we have in our studio lawyer Andrew Orkin, co-counsel for the Dudley George family. He's going to be giving us a bit of an update on that inquisition and some contact information for you to go to if you want to find out what's happening. We played the theatrical play, radio play, a while back on the show.
Yeah, that was good.
Yeah, it was good. It was quite... Do you agree with that theatrical play? Do you think it was accurate?
Didn't have to be. It was a dramatic presentation. So I listened to it not as as a historic drama. It's like listening to Shakespeare about Julius Caesar. The historians are all up in arms about it, but it's damn good theater.
We have a lot of print for a change on this case. And one of the things that really stuck in my mind was the school teacher. Do you want to maybe just give us some thoughts on that story? The school teacher that had to drive out of town to make a phone call.
Well, the whole situation is extraordinary, and her experience was emblematic. She is a remarkable woman, middle-aged or slightly older lady, who has devoted her life to maintaining and attempting to re-disseminate their culture and history among a people whose entire lands were taken from them. So she's become a bit of a cultural and political custodian of the concepts and ideas, and has spent a lot of time studying and learning teaching, and hoped ultimately to return to her Stony Point traditional lands and be a teacher there when the community coalesced again, if it ever did in her lifetime. When the shooting happened, she initially went down to the Ipawash Park to see whether her son had been shot, because he was one of the courageous occupiers, and found that her son hadn't been, but others among the group had been. She got into a car with her elderly mother and drove with the intention of reaching either a farmhouse or a nearby payphone.
Why did she feel she had to get into her car and drive down the road to make a phone call?
Because no help was coming. It was apparent to her immediately after the shooting that no help was coming from the police. And there were no ambulances either on site or in sight. So she did the natural thing that any mother or any citizen would do when there are bodies around that have been shot, is to head off to the nearest place to get help. There was no payphone there, so she leapt into her car with her elderly mother, who had driven out there with her, to reach the nearest payphone.
Apparently she was followed by the police too, wasn't she?
Well, it appears from her testimony so far, and we haven't yet heard police testimony, that the... That there were one or more squad cars behind her. It also appears from police logs that her passage was being logged.
In her statement, she said she was on the phone, and while she was on the phone, there were shotguns pointing at her head while she was making the call.
She reached a payphone some distance from Ipawash Park at the nearest convenience store, and there was a gas bar and convenience store with a payphone in the parking lot. And at the payphone, one or more squad cars with a number of officers pulled up and forced her away from the phone, forced her onto her knees, forced her mother onto her knees, and held shotguns to her head. And interrupted the call, and the call was played, and it was extremely dramatic.
Can you give us a bit more detail about that call?
Well, she called the operator, and she was asked why she hadn't called 911, and she said because she didn't want to call the police, because this was about the police shooting at the First Nations demonstrators. And she was asked by the operator, "Shall I put you through to the police?" And she said, "No, it's the police that are shooting at us." So you had a very confused bell operator not being quite sure who to patch her through to.
Who do you patch through to?
Precisely, but she was patched through to the ambulance services, who in a professional way simply wanted to know where the problem was and what number she was at. But at that point, her call was interrupted by the shotgun-bearing OPP officers at the payphone.
So all of this was done by OPP officers. There is no local police involved?
The TRU, which is a tactical response unit, was consisted in part, and the riot squad, there were 50 riot police and snipers that were involved in the direct confrontation of the demonstrators at Ipawash Park, had some local members who were drawn from local units, but the Ontario Provincial Police was the police force handling the situation.
Now, for those of us out in the audience that don't really have much of a background on the situation, maybe you can tell some of the listeners why they were in the park and what brought it to the point of gun force.
Well, you have to go back to the early 1800s when the Chippewa entered into a treaty with the Imperial Crown, in which it is purported by the Crown that in exchange for a conveyance of over 2 million acres of their traditional lands, they accepted the guarantee that they would be permitted to continue to occupy, use and benefit from three reserves. And the Stony Point Reserve, which was one of the three, was approximately 2,000 acres. Fast forward to the 1920s and then to the 1940s, and the provincial government and the federal government respectively dispossessed the Stony Point people of that reserve. They took it for a provincial park and a military base. The military base was the lion's share of the territory, and that was taken in 1942 under the War Measures Act. They were promised that the lands would be returned to them at the end of hostilities. Last I heard of, hostilities ended in 1945, and the land by 1995 had not yet been returned in spite of significant efforts on the part of the leadership and descendants of the people who had been forcibly removed to have their lands returned to them. Their response, of course, was then to engage in what I would regard as a Canadian citizen as absolutely understandable and predictable civil disobedience and self-help in repossessing their lands. They commandeered a local school bus and drove it through the front boom of the military base in July of 1995, having already climbed fences over the preceding 2 years and built a camp. They had been living already there for 2 years since 1993. Then at the end of 1995, when the provincial park, which was a tiny corner of the land on a beautiful sandy knoll at the highest point of the land, on Lake Huron with a gorgeous beach, where the provincial government had taken a small chunk of their land to make a provincial park in the 1920s, which contained a burial ground, the demonstrators moved over from the military base that they had already occupied. And when the park closed for the season on September the 6th, warned MNR and the park administration that they would be taking over the park, and the park supervisor, the testimony has been so far, handed them the keys, showed them how to operate the plant, and in my view, from a legal perspective, were there with MNR tolerance, if not MNR, that's Ministry of Natural Resources, permission. Unfortunately, within 24 hours of that occupation, a massive riot police and sniper force had been assembled at or near Ipawash Park, and some hours after that, three people had been shot and one killed.
Now, I must ask, why did the police come into the situation? Who ordered that change in direction?
Well, there's a long chain of command, and we do know that the immediate leaders on the ground, which included people of a number of ranks up to inspector, were involved in the bungled series of decisions to confront the protesters. The question is, does that chain of command extend all the way up into Queen's Park? And was Mike Harris and other members of his cabinet implicated in either pressuring or attempting to order the Ontario Provincial Police to take the extraordinary and lethal actions that they did?
Now, it's been quoted in the Toronto Star, among other papers, that Harris did say, "Get those effing Indians out of the park."
We have one witness who has testified that she was told secondhand. This is a former chief and present counselor at Kettle and Stony Point, who testified at the inquiry that she was told indirectly that Premier Harris had said at a meeting in Queen's Park some hours before the shooting, "Get the effing Indians out of the park and use your guns if you have to an OPP officer, a senior OPP officer. That testimony, as I say, is currently hearsay, and we look forward to an opportunity to cross-examine Mike Harris and others who were present under oath and see what their version of that story is.
Will he take the stand? It's been years he's been fighting this.
He has been fighting it, and that's why we've spent 9 years on behalf of the Dudley George estate and the siblings of the late Dudley George attempting to bring about a civil inquiry and, in fact, taking Mike Harris to court while he was refusing to call an inquiry. And we have already examined Mike Harris under oath in discovery in the case of the civil trial, but that discovery occurred in a confidential setting pursuant to the rules of court. So we already have a fair idea of what it is that Mike Harris is willing to testify and what Mike Harris says that he has forgotten.
He's conveniently forgotten quite a few things. Is there anything that you can add to other than this report that he made this statement by a third-party report?
I can't at this time. I can repeat that we're privy by virtue of the civil trial and the discovery process we've been involved in, and also now the disclosures that Commissioner Linden has managed to force under the aegis of this new inquiry, and he has extensive powers of compulsion and, if necessary, search and seizure to compel the disclosure of records, and we are now privy to a significant quantity of evidence that we were not able to obtain over the preceding 9 years. And the most I can say at this point in time is that we really look forward to an opportunity for the public of Ontario and Canada, and perhaps even the world, to gain a sense of how badly this all went wrong.
I can't hardly wait. I'm sure you'll be back to tell us about that. There's no chance that this hearing will be made public, that it'll be broadcast as it goes on, is there?
Well, unfortunately, the communications challenges, even in this 21st century era of instant communication, of the Commission doing this from Forest, Ontario, where the Commission, in its wisdom, has chosen to place its hearings, are not being broadcast. I believe that's a matter of cost. I have seen hearings on CPAC from time to time. Unfortunately, they are not yet available. The transcripts are, however, readable, and they're extremely dramatic. The transcripts can be read on the web, and they're posted there usually by 7 or 8 p.m. on the night of the day on which the testimony was given. And the internet address is www.ipawashinquiry.ca. And then click on transcripts.
That's great. So we can follow along that way.
Absolutely. And even in textual form, for example, the testimony that you referred to of the lady who was really extraordinarily treated at the telephone booth at that incident, and then more recently the testimony that we have just heard one of the occupiers, David George, is Canadian history in the making. And it's awfully, awfully important and should, in fact, be required reading for anyone who's concerned about these rights and issues. And it's excellent reading.
We did a show not too long ago on the other side concerning urban sprawl and treaty rights. And unfortunately, we couldn't link up with you at that time. But it's all across the country that this situation is going on.
Well, the national history of Canada is one of overall dispossession of the First Nations peoples who were here at the point this country was colonized, and colonization is the phenomenon. The Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples, which studied this situation over 5 years in the early 1990s, reporting in 1996, indicated, in spite of the fact that treaties had been signed which were very inequitable, but First Nations across the country were at least and very minimally guaranteed small reserve lands that were supposed to be theirs in perpetuity. And what the testimony has been in the context of this commission and then in the broader context of such situations as the Royal Commission is that Canada and Canadians were not satisfied with the fact that we'd got 99% of the country and reserve lands amount to less than 1% of the country, is we have come back since Confederation for most of the remaining reserve lands. And since Confederation, over two-thirds of the reserve lands have been taken and all of the resources that were on reserve lands. So we have essentially left First Nations peoples not even in possession of the tiny corners of this country that we conceded to them when, in essence, we took the rest.
Now, this is happening right here in Hamilton with the Red Hill Creek and the expressway situation. And one of the arguments we hear justifying putting the expressway right through the middle of the Red Hill Valley is that the natives aren't using that land. They don't seem to understand what the use of this land means to the First Nations, that they're not fishing in the creek every week, that they're not constantly using it.
I'm silent for a while because I hadn't heard that particular argument, and I'm stunned by it. I'm lost for words. It's ignorant and it's racist. I'll call it for what it is. It's an ignorant and discriminatory argument. The right to leave one's own lands in their natural state is a decision that a people is entitled to make, and it's a decision that the dominant society, the rest of us, make often. When we don't build a garage in the middle of our own backyards because we prefer a patch of lawn or a patch of grass, it's a decision we make provincially and nationally when we set aside lands for green space. And to deny First Nations peoples the right to decide that land shall remain fallow, to use a biblical term, is a breathtaking argument. They're not using it, therefore we have the right to take it and pave it over, is stunning. And any mayor or councillor or official that makes that argument should be nothing short of ashamed of his or herself.
You tried to represent some of the members of the native groups that were down there in the valley last summer. Unfortunately, it wasn't too successful, but it was a good opportunity to educate people about the Nanfan Treaty.
Well, we feel that our efforts, brief as they were, did reintroduce the original constitutional documents and the rights that had been guaranteed to the natives involved in 1701. And in that covenant, the Six Nations people, then the Five Nations, were promised that they would enjoy the right to hunt in those territories, which were defined in the treaty but included the Red Hill Valley, forever, were the words, free of any disturbance. And for anyone to argue that those words are empty is to make a mockery of the honor of the crown.
We're talking concepts that generally the white race simply cannot understand.
Well, the white race penned them. That treaty was written down by Governor Nanfan. It wasn't written by the Six Nations. It was written by Governor Nanfan and his lieutenants. And it was signed by Governor Nanfan and the leaders of the Five Nations. And that document still exists, written on parchment, in the State Documents Office in London, as does the map, which we managed to obtain, which confirmed the status of the Red Hill Valley as being part of that promise. The effort we made, unfortunately, broke down, and that's on the public record, because the capacity and means to push it forward weren't forthcoming in the Six Nations camp, if you like. That's probably fruitful subject matter for discussion with Six Nations citizens.
There's so many things to talk about. One of the latest things that has been brought to my attention repeatedly is there's a petition sent in by Bob Hicks. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but he sent in, I think it's 82 A, B, and C, and it's a petition to the INAC. Now, he's got 2 points he was inquiring about. One is the environmental devastation of the Red Hill Valley, but the other is the territorial lands. And he's gotten absolutely nothing back from several levels of government. The federal government and the provincial government keep buck passing back and forth between their two levels as to what course of action to take in regard to his petition. I understand that petitions have to be responded to within 120 days. This is like 10 or 11 months ago.
I'm not aware of the details of that particular petition, but the Ipawash story stands as an example of the terrifyingly useless efforts that have been made by First Nations leaders and others. And they started asking for their land back in 1945, and they knew that the hostilities were over because quite a number of their men were fighting in Europe in World War II, and Clifford George came back to find that his family had been put on the backs of trucks and put elsewhere, and that his farm and his land no longer existed. He knew hostilities were over, And they then proceeded over the next 40 years to write letters to everyone they possibly could and say, when are our lands going to be returned? And they then turned to informational pickets, and they then turned to a march to Ottawa, in which they reached Ottawa, and Prime Minister Kim Campbell refused to meet with them and refused to even acknowledge their presence, and somehow managed to keep them out of the media's eye. And the stories that exist from right across this country of First Nations people politely bringing their legitimate grievances to the attention of local, regional, provincial, and national governments and simply being stonewalled and disregarded. And the fault for that is not in those governments. The fault for that lies with all of us, because we're the beneficiaries of the theft of those lands and the dispossession of those peoples. Our economy is a G8 economy on the basis of those resources having been stolen and taken at the gross impoverishment of the people whose lands they are. And I'm just talking about reserve lands. I'm not talking about the great mass of this country. If my clients and some of the peoples I've worked with simply had their reserve lands returned to them, the lands that we promised to them in writing that they would enjoy as long as the rivers flow, the grasses grow, and the sun shines, their social conditions as peoples would be quite profoundly different. They wouldn't be enough, but they would be quite profoundly different.
Yes, and so some of the stats that the government pushes around about the cases of welfare and drinking and the impoverishment and the lack of education, and it just goes on endless, the abuse that's happened right underneath our noses.
You're absolutely right, and we point to these syndromes and we somehow use it as a tool of blame, and we say that Indians are shiftless, they are alcoholic, they're drunken, they don't work, and you give them stuff and they don't respect it. And what underlies that, those are discriminatory slurs, but what underlies it is a systemic situation of dispossession, not just of lands and resources, but extinguishment of culture and extinguishment of rights, that if we began to talk about those things, we may start understanding the syndromes to which you've referred.
I'm amazed at the fact that I've learned a lot this last year with the situation with the Red Hill Valley. I went down there. We had access to native groups. They had a roundhouse. They had a longhouse. They had the fire burning. They were down there all summer long educating people quietly and peacefully and just telling those that didn't know any better about how they perceived their history, how they perceived the treaties. And it was an open opportunity for people to get educated. But even in that situation, the propaganda from the local press was amazing.
It was more than amazing. It was morally culpable. And at some point in time in future history, I hope we get a chance to reflect on how the bystanders were willfully blind to what was being done. I, for one, know that the information that was necessary for decent citizens to make a correct decision was in the press. The Spec, to its credit, permitted me and my co-counsel, Murray Klippenstein, to publish a large op-ed in which we spelled out all of the issues. So any citizens who cared had enough in front of them to know that this was a fundamental wrong. And I'm not about to say that that people can get off the hook. I'm not going to blame the mayor. The mayor is acting out an ancient charade. He's doing it on behalf of the people who enthusiastically elected him, and that's all of us.
This is a question that's crossed my mind a lot. The fact that the city automatically assumed it was their land.
Well, this is a classic situation because, in effect, it's called contending sovereignties. The city, from its perspective, was correct and could point to a lot of documents that indicated that it has title to that land. Through neglect and submersion, the Nanfan Treaty had fallen off the national radar. It's a 300-year-old document. And it took some court cases in the early 1990s to begin to resurrect it. But a parallel chain of title, which gives the city a sense that it too owns the land, is on the national books. The same was true at Oka. The City Council of Oka had paper in its hand that said it was entitled to take that pine forest and turned it into an additional 9 golf holes.
I remember the very first thing that was said to me when I went down there as an independent to the roundhouse, and one of the clan mothers came down. It's the first time I was introduced to their concept of government, and she said, "Whose land is this?" And I told her as much as I knew, that it was my understanding the city thought they owned the land, and that the natives that were down there camping were trespassers. And
well, the judge whom, in front of whom that issue was put was presented with the documents and so forth and made a decision which, and this might sound perverse, as a lawyer I can understand, the histories of Aboriginal title, treaty title, have, through disuse and suppression, through active suppression, fallen off the national radar. And the judge's decision on its face was a logical one. He was presented by a local government with documentation that indicated that the city owns the land. The truth is that the city's title is defective, its paper title, because the underlying premises of that title are defective. There is a treaty in respect of those lands, and once again the treaty is being suppressed, not only by the actions of the applicants for that injunction, who should have known better, but by the mayors and construction companies that are now paving that land.
Well, their adage has been, build as fast as you can, and then when it finally comes in the court, well, we spent too much money, and we're too far along with our expressway and our highways, now we can't stop.
That's well, we've seen that many times before. There's another thing that I could refer to in respect of the loss of reserve land and the dispossession is that there's if you like, a national program here, which involves encouraging, and I put that word in quotation marks, to First Nations peoples to abandon their communities and leave their traditional lands, because their presence there at the moment is a faint bulwark against their final dispossession. The fact that across this country there are 600 to 700 communities of First Nations people who through their sheer existence and collective presence are defying this program of colonization, and the Government of Canada being in a position of providing local services to all of those communities, because we have so isolated them from the regional economies in which they exist, so they're incapable of providing those services themselves. They are dependent on the federal crown for the provision of healthcare, basic living in the form of welfare. Employment is unknown in those communities, and simple things like clean drinking water, housing, and sanitation. And by withholding those things, and I'm going to state on the public record, in my view, these things are being deliberately withheld. There is a national policy to not provide clean drinking water in First Nations communities on the part of the federal government. We're attempting now to do what we used to do with guns and imprisonment and residential schools through the withholding of basic services, so that a mother whose kids develop impetigo, which is a vicious infection of the skin from sanitation flowing in the streets, or whose children develop gastrointestinal diseases by virtue of inadequate drinking water and sanitation, are forced to move with all six of their children to the nearest city to get medical care, and then they never get back. And I've been told testimony by First Nations people I've met who, in this day and age, in 1998 and 1999, told me that they have lost track of all of their siblings. And it seems to me that this is something that happens in war zones, but should not be happening in a G8 country like Canada.
It's been a fascinating interview, and we have to have you back because there's so many topics to talk about, especially, well, even in this area alone. And, of course, we want to hear what happens with the Dudley George case.
Well, I encourage your listeners to watch for the transcripts. We're actually going to make an effort to try and get a video feed of the inquiry, a guerrilla feed, if you like, or an indie feed of the inquiry.
Yes.
Onto the internet, and if we can do that and get the technology together, there will be one. We'll hopefully be able to watch that as a live stream in a tiny little window on computers. And if we can pull that together, I'd like the opportunity to tell your listeners, or at least to message them, as to what the address is at which they can watch that inquiry.
Glad to help. We'll put that news out there as soon as we get it. In fact, any help you want from independent media, you can always call on Hamilton Indie Media, which I am a member of, and CFMU. Thanks very much for today.
Thank you for having me along.
First-hand lies when he left.
and that is a brand new release from a group called The Elves. That song is called Magpie, and I heard them on the Freewheeling Folk Show for the first time. See you next week. Redefining Radio.
CFM Radio.